order. We want to welcome you out to the Central Rec meeting. We have all kinds of stuff to talk about tonight. Some of it's interesting. Hey,
it's all interesting.
It's all interesting. Anyway, it'll be a good meeting. We'd like to welcome you out. We'll start with introductions. We'll start over here with Christine and then have the board introduce themselves.
I'm Christine Schmidt, non-consumptive wildlife friend.
Richard Hanson, at large.
Chris Marvel, at large.
Carl Hurst, sportsman.
Tim Fair, at large.
Jacob Steele, Goshen Tribe.
I'm Gary Nielsen, I'm a sportsman's rep. I'm also the RAP chair. As you know, and most of you I've seen numerous different times, this is a public forum where you're allowed to express your opinions. We ask that if you have a comment or something to say, that you speak up. We usually have you come forward to the mic, but we're not doing that. We'll just have you speak up today. Also, if you have a comment, there's a comment card there on the table. We'd like you to fill that comment card out. We all feel pretty strongly about our ideas, about what ought to happen, and which is why I'm sure all of us are here. Typically, there'll be about a 15-minute presentation by the division, at which time we'll ask if there's any questions from the RAC. Following that, we'll look for questions from the audience, and I need to remind you, this really is just a question time. Questions are points of clarification. Following that, we'll close a question period, and we'll open it up to a comment period, at which point you can make a comment, offer an opinion, express a view, anything like that. Following that, we will bring it back to the RAC for their vote and disposition. Anyway, our first item on the agenda, we needed approval of the agenda and the minutes from the last meeting.
Move for approval as written.
Okay, we have a motion to approve the minutes as well as the agenda.
Second
from Richard. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Wildlife Board meeting update. For those of you who listened, it was an active and interesting Wildlife Board. A couple of things I might mention. We, at this RAC, talked about how we felt about the Wasatch area. There was quite a few concerned sportsmen here as well as concerned board members. And anyway, John Bear made the motion that we leave it the same as last year's numbers, and that motion failed for lack of a second. I'll go through some of the other ones. The conservation permit, the motion was made and passed unanimously. The Bucks Bowls and once-in-a-lifetime recommendations. There were several different motions. One of them was that they limit the increase of buck permits on the Manti to 150 instead of 500, as the division recommended. That one passed. There was a motion that we increase the bison permits by 10. It was quite a bit of discussion at board meeting. I'm sure, I know some of you guys were there because I saw you there, it was kind of like two sides. We had quite a few farmers and ranchers who felt strongly about what was happening, and they wanted to actually cull numbers now, anticipating drought conditions. And then there was kind of the division side where they wished to, okay, let's kind of see how summer shakes out, and then decide whether or not whether we need to thin numbers down even further. And so there was quite a bit of back and forth there, but as a general rule, some of the wild animals lost. Anyway, another motion was made, the conservation permit sportsman's rule was presented. A couple of them were amended. They passed the antlerless permit ones with a few amendments that they increased the antlerless elk on the Southwest Desert from last year's count by 175, and that would bring the number to 600. They had that new hunt that they're calling
the Hyuna.
Well, the Hyuna one, that one, they put that one out. There was discussion about that one, and that's the one where we used to have this Hyuna's hunt, and then the deer migrate off of there before the deer season starts, and so basically the Wyoming guys get to shoot the Utah bucks that come off the high mountains, and so they added that new hunt, and that one passed. There's a new hunt where they're proposing that you can shoot a cow on some of these areas where they wouldn't need to thin out the cows a little more. They called it a multiple. Is the name of it? It has an actual name.
Was this on the three units down in the southern region? The multi-unit?
The multi-unit. Well, the multi-unit or the multi, where you could actually buy a cow tag if you had a whole permit for that area.
And others control permits.
Right.
Yes.
Anyway, and that one actually passed too, and they increased the numbers a little bit by that on that one. And they the motion was made that the annual CWM permit recommendations as presented by the division, that one passed unanimously. Then the mountain goat unit plan management, the motion was made and that one passed as well. Anyway, it's kind of an interesting, we'll see, you know, and if you watch the range now, I felt pretty strongly about the division's position on let's see how the summer shakes out before we actually mandate killing extra animals, but to a certain extent that one, and there were a couple of areas where that didn't do so well. Anyway.
Yeah.
Right. We'll now have a regional update by John Fairchild.
To all you guys in brown shirts, if this doesn't sound right, correct me. Okay, what's been going on? Well, I've been gone quite a bit, you know, so maybe I'll just stay away. Native Aquatics Program, Salt Lake County Jail pond opening. I don't know if you caught that on the news. It was pretty interesting. An opportunity to create a refuge area for least chub, which is a sensitive species, and do some inmate restoration at the same time, you know, giving inmates an opportunity to be involved in conservation. And I'll tell you, Sheriff Winder gave a pretty good talk or speech about the importance of both. So I thought that if you catch that on YouTube, I imagine it's out there, you'd probably appreciate that. Our sport fish program, we're gill netting this week at Deer Creek at Jordan and Jordanelle. The priority planning efforts for 2015 will be creating a monitoring plan for the Utah Lake fishery and also developing a Jordanelle fishery management plan, and that will take into account a survey that's just been completed online by anglers to give some input, and then also a working group will be convened this summer to work through some of the issues and come up with a recommendation for this RAC and the Wildlife Board. In our wildlife section, spring bear hunt continues through June 5th, and this spring it's an any legal weapon, no bait hunt. Reports of some pretty large boars taken in the 300 plus pound range, and the Central Mountains Manti and Nebo units are limited entry, but this Wasatch West is a harvest objective, and they are seeing several nice boars come off of that. Our biologists did sage grouse let counts. Preliminary data shows that we have sage grouse management areas. We have three of them in our region. The strawberry sage grouse, great, I'll just say SGMA, showed an increase. The Ibapaw and sheeprock SGMAs showed a slight decrease. So just a reminder, I think this September, end of September, is the deadline for the Fish and Wildlife Service to issue their decision on listing of the greater sage grouse, so be looking for that. There's also a bill in Congress, I think a rider to the appropriations, the defense appropriations bill, postponing that for 10 years, so we'll see how that all plays out. Spring range rides and range assessments are scheduled, and if you have an area that you want to look closely at the range or ride through it and see more of it, let our biologists know, and they'll give you the dates. We also have the dates in our office if you want to participate in that. Good opportunity to see what the winter range conditions are. Harvest on the general season turkey hunt appears to be better than limited entry this year, and permits are still available over the counter. That season runs this month, the general season hunt. In our habitat section, we have a 2,300-acre lop and scatter project out in the Vernon area. That's where they're taking juniper and pinyon trees and creating more sage-grouse habitat, quite frankly, which is a good thing. We have 32 habitat project proposals that were submitted for consideration for funding. We expect in the neighborhood of 20 to get funded, mostly pinyon juniper removal to benefit big game and sage-grouse. We have a few proposals. A couple will most likely be approved for funding the Upper Strawberry River. That's going to be from Bull Springs to Highway 40 and then Main Creek in the Wallsburg area. We have a couple areas where we're working with UDOT in our habitat section, funding highway mitigation for big game. Highway 89 in San Pete County will continue to work with a group down there to come up with strategies for dealing with unacceptable levels of big game loss, especially deer, between Mount Pleasant and Sterling. Highway 189 between Deer Creek, the headquarters for Deer Creek State Park, and the Island Boat Marina, is being planned now for the widening that has taken place lower down on in the canyon, and we have an underpass that's gonna be probably installed there right past the Wallsburg turnoff on your way to Heber. So where you cut through, you got the McAfee Hill on the one side and DWR land on the other, there'll be a way to get across there. And that's an area where we've had a lot of big game deer and elk hit. We have grazing on our wildlife management areas that'll start up this month. We have 13 wildlife management areas involved with over 1,500 AUMs being offered. In our conservation outreach section, they've started the second session of the Utah Lake Commission-sponsored school field trips at Utah Lake, and that's being held at the state park, probably, right? That went today, and it'll continue tomorrow, where school kids come in who have been learning about Utah Lake history, get to kind of a hands-on experience with history, geography, natural history, the whole bit. Cutthroat Trout Viewing Day will be at Strawberry May 29th.
30th.
Whoops, 30th. It just got changed. Central Utah DWR Facebook page is now available and seeking friends. Is that fair to say?
You bet.
It's Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, Central Utah. That's what we are. We'll put
a
lot of
that kind of what I said?
Upcoming volunteer projects and such will be on there and things like that.
It'll be a good thing. You get to answer all the posts. Is that the deal?
I'm going to let Tanya and Derek do most of it.
That can be time consuming. Law enforcement. We're announcing for a Salt Lake Tooele Sergeant position, and we're targeting Deer Creek with additional enforcement of the aquatic invasive species regulations that are there. So that's it. From the Central Region News Desk. Yeah, any questions?
All right.
Can I ask them? Yeah. Maybe this is not the right time.
It's always a good time.
Do you have has the division taken any position on federal land, state land?
Our position is the same as the governor's.
Okay.
That's all I need.
That question from last time.
What's that?
That question from last time. Yeah. All right. Thank you,
Dr. Good.
All right. We have several action items tonight. Our first one is the waterfowl recommendations. We have Blair Stringham, the Regional Waterfowl Coordinator, here to present that to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Blair Stringham. I'm the Migratory Game Bird Program Coordinator. I will be presenting the 2015-16 Migratory Game Bird Hunt Recommendations. wanted to go over just a few updates real quick on kind of where we are with our timetable with the Fish and Wildlife Service. From the last several years, we've been working with them to try to adjust the way we do our hunt recommendations to give us a little bit more time to publish those, publish our guidebooks, we'll get hunt dates out to the hunting public. And so the way this is currently working is we meet as flyways in July of each year, and we put forward proposals to the Fish and Wildlife Service for what we want the frameworks to be for that hunting season. The Fish and Wildlife Service then goes through and accepts those in August. At that point, we can go and actually select the hunt dates that we want, as well as the bag limits. Once those are selected, they're published in the Federal Register, and once they're published, we can actually move forward with those hunts. The problem with this current time frame is that there's a huge time crunch to try to get those done between July and September. And if they aren't done, we can't technically hold a hunting season. So the new framework we're going to be working under, we'll meet with us flyways in September. Things will be accepted by the Fish and Wildlife Service in October. We'll likely do our state selection process in December. That's when we'll come forward with the hunt dates for the following season. Once those are published in June, we'll have several months to get our guidebooks out, and hunters will know well in advance when dates will be for the waterfowl season for the coming year. So this right now, we'll be doing the 2015-16 regulations. We're still operating under the old time frame, so that means that currently the Fish and Wildlife Service hasn't adopted what we'll be presenting. So technically, there could be some changes before the final frameworks are accepted. But what we'll be presenting tonight will likely be what Fish and Wildlife Service will accept. And if they don't, we'll go with whatever maximum they allow us to have for season length of bag limit. And then starting December, we'll begin with our 2016-17 regulations. An additional update on our hunter numbers and waterfowl numbers across the continent. We've been tracking hunter numbers here in Utah since about the middle of the 1940s, and for the most part, those have tracked really well with waterfowl populations across North America. We did see quite a dramatic decrease, though, around the year 2000. No one really knows for sure why that occurred, but we really haven't seen hunter numbers rebound since then. Given a wide range of reasons for this, we as a division have started focusing a lot more effort on trying to retain and recruit waterfowl hunters. We've been doing waterfowl workshops around the state to try to increase people's interest in waterfowl hunting. We've also began working on access, try to provide better infrastructure on our WMAs, as well as through the walk-in access program to give people additional areas to go waterfowl hunting. We've also worked on providing resources such as maps, online tutorials, videos, just to help people get better waterfowl hunting skills so they can be more efficient waterfowl hunters. Given the resource that we currently have, we have record duck populations, geese, and swans, so now is really a fantastic time to begin a waterfowl hunting tradition in your family. Last update, just briefly want to talk about the waterfowl duck stamp increase that will go into effect for the 2015-16 season. This is a program that was started by the federal government quite a few years ago. And 98% of the proceeds that have been raised through the duck stamps go directly back into habitat acquisition and habitat easements. Currently, they've raised about $800 million through duck stamps and conserved about 6 million acres across the continent. The last time the stamp was increased in 1991, and at that point, the buying power for duck stamps was a lot greater than it is now. It was estimated in 1991 that an acre of waterfowl habitat would cost about $306 to restore. Today, it's increased quite a bit to about $1,100. And so for that reason, Congress authorized the increase in the duck stamp to go from $15 to $25, and that will begin on July 1st of 2015. So to get into our actual waterfowl population data, this last year in 2014 was the highest record we've ever had for breeding ducks in North America. We almost hit 50 million ducks on the continent, so the highest record recorded count we've ever had. And so, really a ton of ducks out there. Canada Goose number is really about the same. They've been trending upward for quite a few years now. We have an excellent population of geese here in the Rocky Mountain region. We continue to see those increasing just about every year. And lastly, our tundra swan populations. We have a very healthy swan population as well. That population has continued to trend upwards as well. So really a lot of swans here in the Pacific Flyway. So the way our waterfowl recommendations or base, they come largely from the population of mallards in the western part of North America. Whatever that population is doing, we use that as a surrogate for most of the other waterfowl populations. And given that we had such a large breeding population last year, I would suspect, again, we'll have another long season. That'd be 107 days and a bag of seven. We do have several species that have species-specific harvest strategies associated with them, and that's pintail, canvasback, and scop. I suspect that those populations will be doing about what they were last year, so we should have similar seasons to what we had last year. It should be 107 days and two birds for pintails, 107 days and two, possibly one canvasback, and scop should be another 86-day season with a bag of three. For the dates for the general waterfowl hunt season, that'll be on October 3rd and run through January 16th. Given if we do have a scop season that is 86 days, it'll run from October 3rd till December 27th. And all their bag limits should be similar to what they were last year. And if those three species or anything else does change, we'll go with whatever the maximum is of the Fish and Wildlife Service will allow us to have. For our goose zones for dark geese, none of these have changed from previous years. We have three different zones with different hunt dates. The urban zone being the zone that allows us to hunt the longest just to maximize the opportunity to harvest geese that live in the urban areas of Utah. For light geese, we're only recommending one change from what we did last year, and that would be to extend the light goose season for an additional week. We've seen a lot of snow and Ross geese both moving north earlier and earlier in the winter. It's really a race to get to the northern tundras to get the best breeding grounds. And so as temperatures have warmed the last few years, we've seen birds moving north earlier. And so with a February 7th end date, the first segment of that season, it should allow hunters to maximize their opportunity on some of those birds that are moving north really early. The swan season will be the same as it was last year. It'll be just the Great Salt Lake hunt area, and 2,000 permits will be issued for that. Our youth day will be September 19th, and we are recommending again that statewide shooting hours begin half hour before official sunrise and go until official sunset as well, and that would be on opening day as well. And we did this for the first time last year and didn't have any problems. So we're going to continue with that recommendation for this year. We do have one change to the upland game guidebook. That's currently on a three-year rotation, and so everything that was approved last year would be the same this year, except for band-tailed pigeon. We've been working with Fish and Wildlife Service to develop a harvest strategy for this species, and that, given some concerns for the species, the season dates have been reduced from a 30-day hunt to a 14-day hunt, so that's what we'll be recommending this year. The hunt will run from September 1st through the 14th. And lastly, just a few changes in the rule. The name for common snipe has changed to Wilson snipe, so we need to update that in our rule. We also went through and clarified the difference between our rest areas on our WMAs as well as some non-shooting areas. One of the more controversial areas in this section of the rule is Antelope Island Causeway. We had quite a few conflicts in the last few years with people who were burning out there and hunters. So several years ago, we created a 600-foot buffer from the center line of that causeway on both sides just to allow some space between people birding and driving on that road and hunters. We defined that so that people can pretty much participate in any activity along the causeway other than shooting within that boundary. So people can drive boats through that area, they can retrieve birds, they just can't shoot birds that are in that buffer zone or shoot from within that buffer zone at birds that are within or outside of that boundary. We also went through and better defined some of the boundaries for Salt Lake Airport and Great Salt Lake, Boat Harbor, which are a little ambiguous, and also clarified some of our rest areas on our WMAs. And lastly, we went through and we did an update on areas that we allow blinds on our WMAs. And we currently do allow people to have more established blinds outside of our impoundments in areas between the impounded areas and the Great Salt Lake. We just needed to re-clarify one of those in Farrington Bay. We created a Doug Miller unit back in 2008. Prior to that, it was a Crystal unit that was outside boundary, and now this Doug Miller unit is north of that. So that would now become the outermost boundary of our impounded area. So really just kind of technical clarification that we had to update within our rule. And those are all the waterfowl recommendations.
Thank you, Blair. Any questions from the RAC? Danny?
Yeah, on that cosplay restriction, is the division or anybody going to help hunters on that 600 feet? I mean, that's really tough to know what 600 feet is from that rub.
Yeah. So we've had officers out there the last couple of years enforcing that. I believe it was 2013, actually 2012 season when that one ended up back. We haven't had any violations out there from hunters that are actually hunting within that buffer. Really the issue was the way it was worded in our rule, it didn't really allow for any activities out there along the causeway, be that birding or people driving good boats or anything. So most of that clarification came just to find what activities were allowed. Hunters, there are, you know, quite a few, well, they're required to be within or more than 600 feet from any structure currently is So we assume the hunters will take that same diligence to make sure they're at least 600 feet away from the causeway before they begin hunting. If they aren't, then they can.
So the answer is no. There's no attempt to help hunters to know what 600 feet is. There's no signs or anything.
There's like not.
Yeah, that's tough.
And part of that's because it's on the lake. And so
yeah, I know.
Impossible to post.
It'd be tough, yeah. And then one other comment. Last year was the first year that I did not hunt waterfowl in like 35 years, partly because there wasn't very much water. But the problem that I'm having and might contribute to this serious decline in waterfowl hunters is that, you know, so much development is just displaced access so greatly, you know, 600 feet, like you said, but especially for mallards, you know, since they're so urban in nature, you know, so.
Any other questions from the RAC? Questions from the audience? Mm-hmm. All right, we'll close the question period. Are there any comments? I don't have any comment cards. Is there anybody that would like to comment? All right, good job, Blair. You will bring it back to the RAC. Your discussion and disposition. I'll entertain a motion if that's what you'd like to do.
I'll make a motion, Gary, to accept the division's waterfowl recommendations as presented.
Okay, a motion is made by Chris, seconded by Tim. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Okay, our next presentation will be on urban deer control. This is another action item.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott McFarland. I'm the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator for the Division. And this evening, I'll be presenting changes to our current urban deer control rule, R657-65. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Currently, we have an urban deer control rule. This was established as a pilot program with the Highland and Bountiful Cities in August of 2013. The purpose of the rule was to evaluate a two-year pilot program that enabled each city to design and administer a control plan for the lethal or non-lethal removal of resident deer doing damage to private property or threatening public safety. Currently, this rule will sunset. It ends August 31st of this year, 2015. Why did we have this pilot program? Probably the main reason is because we've had an increase in deer that have been taking up residence in urban settings all along the Wasatch Front and actually statewide. So we wanted to test the logistical and economic feasibility of controlling the urban deer population on a large scale basis. And we wanted to also determine the effectiveness and cost of various methods of deer control techniques in an urban setting. So we had Highland City and Bountiful Cities participated in this, and each city chose a different method of initiating this deer control. And I'll go through Highland City first, and I think some of you are probably familiar with this, but Highland City chose a plan to use certified volunteer archers to lethally remove the deer from the properties within the city limits. This is a plan that was designed and directed and totally implemented by the city. The results of that, in 2013, they removed 72 deer using certified volunteered archers, and they logged in 322 volunteer hours, and they donated about 5,500 pounds of meat. This is why their figures that they gave us. In 2014, 42 deer were removed. They logged in 184 volunteer hours to accomplish that. And what this came out to is about 4.5 hours per deer is what it took them to remove those deer. Bountiful City, on the other hand, chose a non-lethal trap and remove program in cooperation with the Division of Wildlife. Bountiful City was responsible for providing employees for the project. They did provide two employees pretty much at our disposal to help with baiting and doing moving traps and things like that. They're responsible for signing up the residents and identifying the trap locations. We wanted them to designate where these deer were coming from or being removed from, instead of us going and dictating that. And they also had to enforce their no feeding ordinance, which is a prerequisite before entering into this. The division was responsible for choosing the appropriate trap method, organizing volunteer efforts. There was a huge volunteer effort that was used to accomplish this. Checking traps and processing the deer, and transporting the deer to an approved release site. The objectives of doing it this way were wanting to determine the effectiveness and the cost of translocation of deer from the city. We wanted to look at public perception pre and post removal, and we wanted to assess the changes in deer vehicle collisions. And the results of that project, we're still into that, but in 2014, we just barely got started in it, and only were able to trap for a few weeks, but they trapped and relocated 36 deer. And during the 2014-15 season, we were geared up for this a lot better. We were able to relocate 211 deer from Bountiful City. And kind of as a comparison, they had 10 to 15 volunteers a day, plus two DWR personnel. It didn't take that many volunteers, but there was a huge interest, and people had fun doing it, basically. It didn't take that many people necessary. So it took about 3 hours a day to process the deer. It was just done in the morning. They checked these traps, and they used several different trapping methods. They used clover trap, which is a box trap. They walk in and trigger it, and also a drop net, a suspended net that they can trigger remotely and drop on the deer when they're eating some bait underneath. But they averaged 6 deer per trap day. And as a comparison with Highland City, it took about a little less, about 3.8 hours per deer, not including the transportation. And I'll have to qualify that. I tried to figure out what was necessary for the personnel. I didn't include everybody's hours in there as the volunteers. The non-necessary, I was looking at the necessary workforce for it. And so it took about 3.8 hours per deer, is how that came out. So the preliminary results on this is that basically both methods were effective in removing deer from within the city limits. The non-lethal methods were definitely more costly and time and labor intensive. The survival estimates with the non-lethal removal have not yet been determined. These were translocated to two different sites in the state, far enough away that they didn't come back, or they shouldn't have come back. None of them have so far. We still have one more year left to complete the project. And one of the things that we did realize is that, and we kind of knew this before, but non-lethal removal is not always an option in some areas. So we get to the changes to the current rule. The purpose of this current rule was and still is to enable a city to design and administer a control plan for the lethal or non-lethal removal of year-round, we stress resident deer, damaging private property or threatening public safety within the city. So the changes to the current rule we already have in place is we would make this available statewide, not just Bountiful in Highland cities. It would go be made available to cities statewide with a population greater than 1,000 residents. The emphasis is on targeting resident year-round deer. We will require an annual report of lethal removal activities, and also that the cities must, if they're going to choose a non-lethal removal or a capture relocation in their plans, they must petition the division to include that. And the division does have the sole discretion to authorize or prohibit such activities as part of that plan. We've got some safeguards in this. So the division, basically their role will be with the cities is to provide seasonal time period when the deer may be removed, basically a starting and stopping date. The total of deer that may be removed from within city limits, and the number of deer by gender that may be removed. That might be adjusted with time of year too, with the gender of deer. The annual report is required by the division on lethal removal. The capture and live removal has to be agreed on and authorized by the division. And the division or the city can terminate the plan, the division or the city can terminate the plan within 7 days with written advance notice. And the cities have to renew their authorization every 3 years and must go through the public review process. We didn't want them to just keep on going with this without having the public input on this, whether yay or nay, whether they should be proceeding with this. So the process that a city would go through, basically, to kind of sum this all up, is that the city would obtain a certificate of registration, a COR, from the division, which is basically authorize them to create a plan, create and implement a plan, staying within the sideboards of what is stated on the certificate of registration and within the rule. So the city would design the plan with public input following, like I said, the stipulations in the COR and the rule. The city would present the plan for public comment. They implement the plan after the public has okayed that. The city then has to provide annual reports to the DWR on any lethal take, and the city has to renew their COR or this plan every 3 years after going through the public review process, so that it's made sure that it's a public good acceptable thing. The city's good. With that, thank you.
Thank you, Scott. How far did they move the deer when they moved them?
We took them quite a ways. We went to two different sites. One was northern Box Elder County. We went through, and one the other one was out at Big Wash in Duchesne County, down near the basin there. And we chose those sites. We went through the state with all the biologists and had them look for sites and submit sites for translocation sites and given certain criteria. One of the criteria is that it couldn't be affecting agriculture, you know, damage-wise. They had to have low or no deer populations that historically had good deer populations. So there's quite a few criteria we put on there. And so they went through the rack and board process for these, I believe it was last fall or a year ago last spring. I can't remember when, but we went through the process to identify these sites. So we had places to go. But yeah, they were taken quite a ways away.
Okay. Any other questions from the rack? Danny?
Yes. It was implied, but I assume that once you captured these deer, you marked them some way.
Yeah.
Actually, there's a project to monitor the survivability. And also, we have to mark these deer because of the disease testing. We want to test everything for chronic wasting disease. Right. So everything was marked with either a radio collar or an ear tag transmitter on the bugs. And so they were all marked there.
Tim?
So was there any thought given to requiring the cities that apply for this process to actually somehow pay part of the DWR costs for administering the program?
Yeah, there is thought. And what the way this would work is that if they choose a non-lethal program, if they choose a lethal program, we'll probably not have any part of those costs anyway. If they choose a non-lethal removal program, there are going to be costs associated with that. And what we want to do is enter into an agreement with them so that we know what each party is going to do. And obviously, you know, we will have input into that, but also the city would have input financially also. And so it's going to have to be an agreement. And if so many cities do that, that it overwhelms our abilities, it'll have to be on a priority basis. Yes.
Chris? Yeah. Got a couple questions for you, Scott. So I looked through this a little bit, and does it specify somewhere that the deer must be taken within city limits?
It does. They have to all be within taken.
Okay, I didn't notice that, but there was a lot here. So, but it does specify.
It specifies it.
They can't range out.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. They if they're to try and take care of anything outside of city limits, it would require written permission from the division. But the intent is to have them taken from all within the city limits.
Okay. So the next question that I had was, so obviously, so they submit, so just walk me through this just so I understand it in layman's terms. So,
okay. So
a city submits a plan, says we have 1,000 deer, we want to take 500 of those deer out of city limits. So I'm assuming you're going to approve all that before they start, or you're going to have tight sideboards on how many deer they can take legally and that sort of thing, right?
That's correct. As I said before, the division's part in this will be setting the time frames when they can do that and the numbers that will be taken. So,
okay, but so they submit a report annually and that's all they're required to do. What happens if they overshoot the runway and kill too many deer?
We would pull their certificate of registration.
So okay.
We remove their ability to do that.
And then lastly, the last question I had, Scott, was, is there any requirement? So if a city is taking deer lethally, is there any requirements around what they do with those deer? Besides, I saw something about antlers, but I didn't see anything about meat.
Yeah, there is a part in there, and I'd have to read the exact wording on that, but it says that the meat has to be disposed of according to law, which means it can't be wasted. It can be donated, there's a lot of ways that they can dispose of it, but it has to be done according to the law. Antlers all have to, like you said, all have to be certain.
Right. Okay. All right, thanks, Scott.
Lethal tag program, do those archers have to have a valid permit? Can they take more than one deer, or how does that work?
That's provided for in rule, and how it would work was the city is to, they can designate or contract or do whatever they want. We're going to stay out of that part, but they do have to tag them. There will be an approved tag for that. And yes, people, a single individual under this program would be able to take multiple deer, more than one deer.
Okay, so it's all it really involves is the cities want those deer removed.
Right.
And that's really, doesn't matter if one guy does it or five. So.
That's right. And so basically what the division is doing is conveying the right to take those deer over to the city and allowing an individual to go outside the boundaries of normal businesses. They can only take one deer, and they'll be able to take multiple deer.
And one other question. Sometimes in some years, you know, we may get some really early storms that force the deer down into those city boundaries. Do you have the right to just say cut it off? I mean, if you see that?
Yes, we would have that ability to do it.
Okay.
like I said, we can terminate any plan or alter it if needs be. We can come to the city and say we need to, with 7 days, we can notice. So.
But your main focus is resident there, though, anyway, right?
Yeah, and we, that's one of the things we did change in the rule, was we wanted to make the focus on resident deer. They're the ones that are doing the problem, causing the problem.
How do they feel like it went in Highland this year? Did they see, they're seeing progress? Are they seeing a few less deer causing problems, or not enough to notice yet?
You know, I think they have. I don't know if sure. Kobe, would you like to address that?
Yeah, so I guess, Gary, I don't want to get the numbers wrong. There's no mic here. It's not good. So at the first year, they took 72, John? 72 or 76? 74. Close. So, and they worked pretty hard to get those deer, but they were able to take that many. And the next year, they're down in the 30s. And they feel like they're heading towards maintenance. So, and they, you know, I don't think it's statistically valid, but they did show a difference in in-city accidents and things like that. I mean, our roadkill numbers are down there, so...
So I think they said 40%.
Yeah. So I mean, I don't know how.
You don't know what to attribute that to, but it, actually. But
they were crashing like three or four of their own police cars a year in the deer. So they're doing better. They still have some areas with some residents that really like the deer, and we tried to help out with one of those hot spots, but the residents don't want them removed, so they're harboring these animals and then go and cause problems everywhere else. Yeah, it'll just take some time to work through, but it's a lot better than it was.
Okay, thanks.
How much interest is there going to be with other cities? You've got it in two places now. How much interest?
In the northern region, we addressed this last night, and I think they said there was 6 to 8 cities that were already expressing interest in this.
That'd be similar bizarre. Here.
What's that?
That'd be similar here.
Yeah. So it's similar in the central region here. They're actually pretty excited to have some form of making some relief from the problems that they are having, you know, being able to do it themselves.
A mix of lethal, non-lethal, or are they going?
Probably. I think Mapleton's probably just looking at lethal removal, to be honest. But where you have more agricultural land, you got more options to go, you know, lethal.
Yeah, kind of as a maybe a little bit of a contrast there, that North Logan City is expressing interest in doing lethal and maybe even trapping and lethally removing. Some of them have expressed an interest in using archery, similar to Highland City, what they've done. Some of the cities have said that there's not a lot of political support to do with non-lethal, and so they might be contracting or making a plan with the division for a non-lethal removal plan. So it's kind of all over the board right now.
Could I add something? Maybe it would be helpful. There are some provisions that, you know, that they have, cities are going to have to meet in order to qualify, and that was in the rule that you got to read, but might not have been in the presentation, that they pass an ordinance, that no feeding ordinance, you know, for deer, that they, if necessary, they change their discharge ordinance to allow for archery or crossbows, you know, to take within city limits. And they have to have, you know, most large cities have $1 million, you know, insurance policy, you know. But for some of these smaller towns, that's a, you know, that could be an issue. So there's some standards that they're going to have to meet. And then those public meetings that they have to hold and get public support for will be highly emotionally charged. I've been in them, and you get 50 people on this side of the room, you know, with a different opinion than the 50 on that side of the room, and it's going to be a tough call for some of these cities to get, you know, get signed up. You know, politically, they may not have the support, and they may not want to pay for it. So,
Yeah, so as a consumptive, non-consumptive user, I'm just curious where a lot of that venison ended up.
Kobe, you know where?
Yeah. So at first they started they would donate it right to Myers, which is a meat processor, and then Myers would their end of the deal was Myers would give it out. But after a while, back to a homeless shelter or whatever, but after a while, the city started to compile a list of just needy families that would call in, and they would donate the meat right to a family that was in need. And I'll tell you, that's one of the great success stories of this, is that there were several people that really were very thankful and benefited from this. It's really a win-win. You know, you don't have the deer dying on the roads, you don't have the damage to the cars, and you have somebody who really needs the meat using it. So
I think by their statistics, there's something like over 20,000 meals. We're figuring how many, so many pounds of meat, so many pounds of meals to donate that.
Yeah. Hey, Scott, one more question. So I see the definition of a resident deer is a deer that lives there all year round. How are we safeguarding to make sure that when a city reports these are resident deer, they're in fact resident deer? Are you going out to look at them? Or?
Well, we're going to have to use the division in the process for that.
We have a pretty good handle on that right now. I mean, we know which cities have resident populations. They're not. This problem isn't new.
Right.
And so we get the phone calls from the people in the city saying, come get your deer, come get your deer.
But some cities have problems with migratory deer, though, right?
And some it's a combination.
Yeah.
You know, but like, and we know that a place like Mapleton, you'd be more careful about your season dates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
And that's the way we would have to regulate that, is we would set the season dates when we know that the majority of the resident deer are there. When we start getting migratory deer in there, we'd probably have to shut down. Designing plans for that. I used Channing Howard as an example last night. Somebody asked and said, how do you tell the resident deer from the non-resident deer? And they bait them with apples. And what she does is she rolls the apples out there. If the deer run, it's a migratory deer. If they come towards her, it's a resident deer. So, just tongue in cheek.
Yeah, but that's good.
Any other questions from
you? Can you just confirm bucks, does, they're shooting them all?
Yeah, we can, depending on what is the atmosphere for the city, but we can regulate the number of bucks that can be taken and the time of year that they can be taken. Sometimes there's resident bucks that are doing just as much damage or more damage than the does are that you would allow them to be taken early. But obviously during the rutting season, during the breeding season, there's a lot of mountain deer that might come down in. We probably would regulate it so that those bucks could not be taken during that time. So.
And if I know the meat's being donated, antlers come to division?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Any other questions from the rep? Questions from the audience? You come forward and state your name.
Ben Lauder. Just want to make sure I'm understanding. I think I've got this understanding, but I just want to make sure. So Highland went lethal route, selected a handful of archers to take care of the harvest and did it with archery tackle. If I understand right, the plan doesn't specify what weapon or what method of take. That's up to the city.
Yeah, so it has to be a legal weapon to take deer with. But sure. It's going to be up to the city. So
okay.
They could use, if it was appropriate, they could use archery equipment, firearms, even crossbows. Is a legal weapon to take.
And then selection process for who they're going to have take care of the harvest is up to the city?
That's totally up to the city.
The city to determine how and who.
Right. Yeah, we're going to be involved.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. And they have an archery. I remember the archery guy. There was a guy that owned the archery shop that actually certified the archers.
Right, that was Brian Cook, and I don't remember the name of his archery shop.
Humphrey's Archery.
Humphrey's Archery.
The city contracted with Brian.
Okay. Any other questions from the audience? Okay, I'll close the question period. Any comments from the audience? Okay, seeing none, we'll bring it back to the rack. Go ahead, Chris.
I'll go ahead and make a motion to accept the division's proposal for the urban deer control rule amendments as proposed.
Motion is made by Chris, seconded by Tim. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. We'd like to recognize Calvin Crandall, one of our board members, who is with us tonight. We appreciate him coming by. Mike Gates also made it, and Danny made it. Anyway, I appreciate them making the effort to get here and being here. It's always nice to have a large quorum. Our next item is a region-specific item. It has to do with the Central Region North Santa Pete Habitat Management Plan. We have Mark Farmer here to present that to us.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a point of order. I'm listed as the aquatics manager, and I want to tell you the difference. I'm a habitat manager, habitat program manager. Typically, I smell like sagebrush, sometimes juniper, and occasionally wildflowers. Aquatics managers always smell like fish, so that's like. So I'm here to present, we have a habitat management plan for some properties we manage in the northern part of Santa Fe County. And presenting it to you folks is part of the review process. We own about 30,000 acres in Santa Fe County, and we're going to talk about four of those properties in the northern part tonight. So why does the division own property like this in Santa Fe County? The primary reason is to preserve and protect critical big game winter ranges, which are important in those areas for those birds. Secondarily, we want to minimize depredation by big game animals on surrounding private agricultural lands. And we also like to provide opportunities for our constituents for hunting. So what is the Habitat Management Plan? Well, it describes the property to be managed. We describe how the lands are going to be managed. Some of the goals and objectives are listed, and strategies that we will use to manage those properties. And the HMP process, the Habitat Management Plan process, requires, we're required by law to make or to prepare a habitat management plan for each of these WMAs or wildlife management areas. That's part of the code. And participation by interested persons is also part of that process. And these plans require a review process for approval, and that's part of this, what we're doing tonight, to review that. Coordination is also an important part of that. We started coordinating with local landowners and interested parties back in the winter of 2013, held public meetings. We've met with the county, County Access Committee, Bureau of Land Management, to review the plan, and adjacent private landowners. So this HMP, or Habitat Management Plan, contains four WMAs totaling about 4,000 acres. These include the Fountain Green, Big Hollow, Christian Springs, and Apple Tree Springs WMAs. They also include in the plan, as I mentioned, Brown Eye Fountain Green and Hilltop Conservation Easements, which occur in this area, but these will have their own plans. And they also mentioned the three aquatic conservation easements for spotted frogs near the Fairview, town of Fairview, that are mentioned in the plan. And most of these properties were acquired in partnership with the Fish and Wildlife Service Federal Aid Division. Here's a map of the general location. See the properties in brown are the ones we're talking about. Right here. The red properties are our conservation easements. That just kind of shows you where they're located. Next map is going to show you land ownership. You can see that we have some BLM land adjacent to our properties here. But for the most part, there's a lot of private land in this part of this herd unit. And that's kind of unique because most of the time our properties are right up against the forest boundary. Here we've got a lot of private land around some of these properties, which presents some different challenges for managing these properties. some of the habitat characteristics. These properties are basically big sagebrush and pinyon juniper predominant, at least before the wood hollow fire. That's affected things a little bit. We'll talk about that more. We got gamma low pressure mixed mountain shrublands at the higher elevations. Shrub communities are typically moderately browsed, moderately heavily browsed by land big game, as seen in the bottom right hand corner. That's our fountain green property. A lot of deer pile in there in the wintertime. The wildlife species we're looking at on these properties, primarily mule deer and elk, we're managing for. Secondarily, there's upland game birds, raptors, songbirds, cougar, bobcat, coyote, things like that. Management issues, habitat restoration. You can see that that's a picture from the Wood Hollow Fire of 2012. That burned completely two of these properties, the Christian Springs pretty much completely, and the Big Hollow property, and it burned part of the Apertree Springs property. Annual operation maintenance, our weed program is pretty intensive with all these acres. We spend a lot of time spraying weeds. Public access and use is a good deal, and boundary issues occasionally with adjacent landowners. How this plan is broken down is have these categories here, and things are listed under these headings. The background information basically talks about the purposes of division ownership, historic uses of the properties, public recreation opportunities, key wildlife species, historic grazing. Property information is next, and that talks basically talks about the descriptions of each property, the land acquisition history, the encumbrances that are on the properties. Property inventory lists the existing capital improvements, also cultural resources that are there, sensitive species information, habitat types and condition, habitat limitations, community related problems. The next section is management goals and objectives. This basically talks about how this plan relates to the vision strategic plan, species management plan, and the wildlife action plan. And then comes the strategies for property management. This is managing things like fences, roads, weeds, signs, things like that. And then the strategies for habitat management, where we talk about, you know, what kind of habitat improvement are we looking at. Talk about grazing and using that as management tool. We talk about fire management. These properties are low enough elevation that we want these any fires to start fought pretty aggressively from the beginning because of the winter range, their winter range, and there's a lot of fairly close houses and other infrastructure. Access management is also an important part of this plan. How do we allow, you know, what access do we allow for the public? And we actually have an access plan that's an appendices at the end of the habitat management plan that goes into the detail on the access part. So the DWR strategic plan, we're basically, all the things that we do correspond to these goals and objectives. The first goal is to expand wildlife populations and conserve sensitive species by protecting and improving wildlife habitat. And then we have objective one, protect existing wildlife habitat and improve 500,000 acres of critical habitats and watersheds throughout the state. Objective two, increase fishing game populations to meet management plan objectives and expand quality fishing and hunting opportunities. And that's where we really want to expand those opportunities, and our properties are a good place to do that. And number three is conserve sensitive species and keep them from being listed as threatened or endangered. We don't have, historically there was sage grouse in the fountain green area, but that's been decades ago, so we really don't have that issue there on these properties. So some of the strategies for habitat management, and these correspond to the strategies in the deer and elk species management plans. Restore critical habitats and improve water developments for wildlife. Noxious weed control, I talked about, that's a big deal. Especially with the Wood Hollow Fire, restoring our winter browse species is one of our big focuses, because we lost a lot of our shrubs. And when we ever have another tough winter, we'll need those shrubs to keep deer going through the winter. Another objective strategy in the deer and elk management plan is pursue land trades and conservation easements that lock up and improve public access and preserve critical wild habitats adjacent to WAs. And monitoring is always important, monitoring our conditions and trends. And lastly, managing OHVs according to our access plan, which I mentioned earlier, and we'll go over that just a little bit more in a second, which is right now. So the access management plan, the purpose of it is to ensure that public access and use of the WMA is done in a manner that assists the division in achieving the goals and objectives outlined in the Habitat Manager Plan. So, and that was to review. Primary goals are to preserve and enhance protected winter range and reduce depredation on surrounding private lands. So if we can meet these goals, whatever access that we have, as long as we can meet these goals, we'll continue to have that access. So the access management plan, some of the issues that we deal with that is user-created roads and trails is always a big issue. This part of the county, it's not nearly as big as further south. We have properties a lot closer to population areas. Vandalism is always an issue, trash dumping, fire, wildlife harassment, poaching, some of the things we deal with. So the access plan will be basically most of the roads on the properties will be seasonally closed between December 1st and April 30th annually. The county roads will be open year-round, each WMA will have an access map showing legal motorized routes and trails, and here's an example of those. And once this is finalized, those approved routes will be signed, and unapproved routes will be closed and signed as closed. So we don't, have more roads every year and user-created roads increasing. So this year, two of the properties, the county road at the bottom of the Big Hollow property, that's obviously open year-round. Fountain Green on the left there is a little more unique. It's a small property, it gets a lot of use, so the roads in red there are administrative use only. Public access through the south end of that property goes to the beyond ground to the east, so the rest of that property will be walk-in access only. So with that, is there any questions? Okay.
Yeah, so you mentioned sage grouse, they're not there. Is there any thoughts of reintroducing them? Or is the habitat just so poor that...
No, it's so that area is not in a sage grouse management area. We only have the Vernon, the Scarberry, and the Ivanpah. So they won't be any... You can't really introduce them unless you've got a population that's still there and you've got legs that are still active. So no.
So every lek that we lose, that's it?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Any other questions from the rack? I've probably been familiar with that area for 40 years. It's been longer than that since there's been sage grouse there.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I still hear occasional reports around Fountain Green, especially on the kind of the west side of on those hills, the sagebrush hills. Occasionally, people say they see a sage grouse here and there, but we don't have any legs in the area, so I don't know. It could be a misidentification sometimes.
Yeah.
Too.
Any other questions from the rack? Questions from the audience? Calvin.
Come to the microphone or just stand in the middle here. There is no microphone. Well, that makes it easy. Calvin Crandall. Question for you on these WMAs. These are all fee-owned lands that the division owns?
Yes.
That they have purchased through the federal something-something, Pittman Robinson Fund, something like that. Those were taken out of private ownership. Does the state do any kind of payment in lieu of taxes back to the state for property taxes on those?
Back to the county.
To the county?
Yes.
So there are payments similar to what the federal government pays in the PILT program?
Yes.
So those do get paid? Okay. That was the only question I was going to ask, if they're all fee-owned, but reading through the information, they're all fee-owned and have been for a while.
It's longer than I've been here.
So. Okay. All right. That was the only question I had. So, thank you.
Thank you, Calvin. Any other questions from the audience? Okay, we'll close the question period. Are there any comments from the audience?
Yeah, it's just information.
All right. You up?
You're up.
No, you're up.
What am I up for?
That's
election, a new rack.
Well, I guess it is me. Okay. Well, at this time, we have to recognize that Gary is his term is up. Tim also has decided not to go for a second term. There's a third. George Holmes, his second term is up. So we're in the process of, this next Monday, we'll be interviewing for replacements. In the meantime, Gary is still involved with Richard in helping me select, interview and select replacements. But tonight is a night when you need to elect a chair and a vice chair. So I guess we would take the nominations for the chair first. And if someone has a nomination to offer up, go forth.
I'd like to nominate Richard Hansen as chair of the Central RAC.
Okay, do we have any other nominations? Okay. Do we have a second for that nomination? Okay. I would say that all those in favor of Richard Hansen for your chair, say aye or raise your hand. Any opposed? Looks like you have the support of the group.
Okay.
Okay. Let's have a nomination for vice chair.
How about Carl?
Okay, any other nominations? Not seeing any, we don't have to vote. We'll just get a second for that.
I'll second also.
Okay, all those in favor, Carl being the vice chair. Any opposed? That was easy. Okay. Now, I get to present gifts. Isn't it time for gifts? Parting gifts? Or do we want to close the meeting? Let people go, but whatever. It's up to you. You're the chair, still. You guys are going to have to remind me. George isn't here, and I can't remember who asked for what, but I know I have the right one, so I brought them all in. I have a bighorn sheep and a color elk and a black and white deer. Gary, which one's yours?
Sheep.
Okay. These are prints that we get. We've got just a carte blanche with Clark Bronson, you know, to use his artwork, and it's pretty incredible that over the years we've been able to use his artwork to recognize people that have contributed a lot of time, and we appreciate the time you've contributed. So in recognition of the 8 years, he gets the bighorn sheep print. Thank you very much. Tim, which one was it?
Colored elk.
Tim Fair has been on for 4 years. We would love to have him for another four, but it's not in the cards for you. You got other priorities that you need to deal with, and we certainly understand, and we appreciate all the time that you've given us and the service that you've provided. So, thank you very much. And I'll make sure George gets the big buck. Thank you very much.
Okay, meeting stands adjourned. We appreciate you guys for being here. The board meeting to address the issues we talked about tonight is June 4th at 9 a.m. in the DNR boardroom. And we'll adjourn until our next meeting. RAC members, if you could just stay for a second before we all peel out. Thank you.
I'm not really very good at this because when stuff matters to me a whole bunch, and gets right to the bone when you try to talk about it, but I appreciate you gentlemen and ladies for your efforts. You have the sense and the feeling that wildlife matters as much to you as it does to me. I think if we have good people, you've heard the quote that the way evil or bad can take over is for good people to do nothing, and I appreciate you willing to step up and stand up and take an active role in doing what you want as far as making good things happen. I appreciate that. I feel like almost like kindred spirits, but I appreciate you and your time, and thank you for the opportunity I've had to participate with you.
Thank you.